Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years, and it is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. So to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping, astronomical, massive, gargantuan 25% off of your subscription. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! Sarah! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes, that is better.
Welcome back for another installment of the KINGCAST here on the Fangoria Podcast Network. For any new listeners, we are a show in which creative people come on and talk about the work of Stephen King. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And today, our guest is Mr. Joel Souza to talk about one of my favorite King short stories. Although, I don't know, I think this is a little bit obscure, wouldn't you say, Eric?
Yeah, no, I had to actually look it up when you're like... So I run a Stephen King podcast. I've done it for over five years now. Mm-hmm. And when you sent that, I'm just like, are you sure that's not a Stephen R. King book? And then I looked at him, I'm like, oh yeah, of course, it's that story.
It's called A Death. It was first published in the March 9th, 2015 issue of The New Yorker, and it's collected in The Bazaar of Bad Dreams. This is a weird one for King. It's a rarity. In his little intro to it in The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, he even says this is a not my usual style, not my usual thing. It's a period piece, for one. He's usually, almost all of his stories are set in sort of contemporary times. Mm-hmm. Although he's been around so long that some of them feel like period pieces from the 70s. A Death is a Western. It's set, I don't think it's set at a determined time, but it's obviously the late 1800s in the Dakota Territory, a small town that has a sheriff that is investigating the death of a young girl and accuses kind of a slow-witted man who lives on the outskirts of killing her. And taking her silver dollar. Joel Souza has also made a Western that's coming out now. It's a spare, very harrowing drama called Rust. It's out May 2nd. He's also the director of the 2019 cop drama Crown Vic with friend of the show, Thomas Jane. Joel, welcome to the KINGCAST. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Rust is coming out soon. You have, or may already be out by the time we post this show. The listener have probably heard about Rust because it is, the movie, in which a very horrible, unfortunate, horrific accident happened. A gun held by Alec Baldwin during a rehearsal was loaded with a real bullet by the armorer, the assistant director who is responsible for checking safety on set did not catch this, and as a result, the gun went off. Cinematographer Helena Hutchins was killed, and that same shot that killed her also struck Joel, who was gravely wounded by the shot, struck in the shoulder, nearly lost his life too. Joel, when I interviewed you for Vanity Fair, you talked about the bullet was how close to your spine?
I think it was probably about 1.5 inches to the right. Yeah, that's where it sort of lodged. It went in and ricocheted all over the place, essentially, and made some turns and, missed some vital things by very narrow margins, apparently.
Well, I'm glad you are here with us. I know this has been a hard few years. It's hard enough making any movie. It's unfathomable what you've gone through, what the family of Helena has gone through. What everybody associated with this has gone through. And I know there's some complicated feelings that people are going to have about Rust. And I want to hit that right here at the top and
yeah, rip that Band-Aid off right at the beginning. Yeah.
Joel and I have done numerous interviews at through Vanity Fair. And if you want to read his full thoughts on this, you can check out those stories. I don't want to belabor it or make you relive really awful stuff on this show, Joel, but some people might wonder why finish the film? Why come back and complete it? This terrible thing happened in the middle of making it. And I know you wrestled with that too. So what is your answer to that? Why did you finish Rust?
Yeah, it's that's a good damn question. there are times when I still find myself asking that for various reasons. But, I think it was about maybe a year had gone by or close to a year after, what had happened. And I'd start to hear whispers about, through my manager at the time or whatever. They're like, oh, they've sort of approached and said, would you consider it? Would you consider coming back? And I always said, absolutely not. There's no way in hell I can go back to that. And at the time, frankly, I just also thought there's no way in hell I even wanted to ever do this for a living anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a thing I wanted since I was 8 years old, since the boulder rolls down and chases Harrison Ford down the tunnel. I mean, that was it for me. And then this thing that's your lifelong passion, your lifelong joy and dream turns into this nightmare. And that was very difficult. And so, but then people started relaying to me, well, this is, her husband Matt is very interested in doing this and wants this. And I thought, well, then I'm going to need to start having some other conversations with people, talk to Matt and sort of find out what's really behind all this. And, in finding out that it was very important to Matt that her final work not just vanish and not just disappear. He had seen the footage and felt like it was the best work of her career. I agreed. She was just all her strengths were just a natural for a Western. But it was important to him, and he wanted the people who knew her and loved her to have this, and not that this wouldn't just be lost, and that people who didn't really know her but knew about her could learn something else about her other than just what happened, And I knew that, I had heard also that her mother wanted the movie to be finished very badly, and then there's also, I was never really privy to, there were these settlements going on, and I wasn't a party to those, but I knew that the movie was going to financially benefit the family. And once those sort of two elements were in place for me, it went from being a very torturous decision to a very easy one. And so I decided, yeah, I'm going to come back and it's going to bump for some people. And I don't really care because I know why I'm doing it. And, I've sort of thrown around the turn of my head a lot. Well, it felt like the right thing to do. And I don't know that there was a right or wrong decision there. It's what I knew I had to do. It's what I could live with. And even just the thought of, what if they bring in another director to finish this thing who didn't know her and they didn't start this together. I couldn't live with that. I couldn't do it. And I knew that I'm the kind of person, I just can't, it would just eat at me forever. And maybe there was some selfishness in that I wanted to sort of free myself of not going through that for the rest of my life.
Right.
But I knew that this was going to benefit a lot of people that were very important to me. And from that point forward, people can have their opinions about it. I don't begrudge them, but they also don't sway me. So
tell us about preserving Helena's work. I think the cinematography is really beautiful, and you can see some of those shots. We did a story just not too long ago about Rust. People can check that out. A first look at the movie. We've touched upon the accident and the death and the trials and all that numerous times in the interviews I've done with you. But this one, we wanted to talk about the story and itself as a movie. It has been finished, and it's often shocking to people, Joel, isn't it, when they learn that everybody knows it's a Western, but then they find out it's about a kid who is accused, is sentenced to death for an accidental shooting. And the irony of that, I think, catches a lot of people off guard. How does that irony sit with you?
No, it, I don't think it even occurred to me until like half a year later,
Yeah.
because I was just in such a strange space. I was in such a reactive kind of, just trying to emotionally survive. And I was not a picnic for people. I know that for sure. I was just a basket case. But it sort of stopped me cold. And when I remember telling a few people about that at the time and saying, well, this is what the movie's about. And they would go very quiet and almost didn't know how to react to it. And, there are strange parallels in life. And that's definitely one of them. I mean, I don't believe that there are larger things at work in this world in general. And sometimes, and I think everything that sort of lines up happens to be just happenstance and coincidence. But that one is a lot to process,
Yeah.
frankly.
Well, we want to move on to Stephen King and a death, but the last thing I want to ask you about this is just describe Helena's work. You had to bring on another cinematographer, Bianca Klein, to fill her role, but one of the things I think is really interesting is you and I went through the film, and there are scenes that Helena created with you before her death that you preserved. There are some that had to go because when you came back to finish it, you didn't get the same actors. So sometimes you would use you would use the shot of them from behind walking, the marshal walking through the town square. That's one actor. You turn it around to see his face, and it's a different actor shot years later by a different
In a different
cinematographer
state.
in a different state. But there was one scene, correct me if I'm wrong about misremembering this, but there, the little boy is put on trial, and you had to recast the boy, of course, because he grew up in that time. But you said this was an example of Bianca recreating a shot that Helena did create, but imitating the framing, the lighting, the lightness and the darkness. Tell me about preserving her work and what it was that how her imagery makes you feel when you see it.
We had two major locations for this movie. We did the first portion of it in New Mexico and the second portion of it in Montana. They're both incredibly beautiful for very different reasons. And so I always like to joke. It's like, oh, well, and where we were, you could sort of close your eyes, spin around, and open your eyes, point your camera, and you'll have something beautiful. Well, I think we all know there's a lot more to it than that.
Much more.
And
Especially when you're creating an ominous atmosphere from a beautiful place, which is so
yeah,
much of what
exactly. And
infuses this movie.
Helena and I had talked a lot about, what we wanted from a Western. And I always felt like, I don't think Westerns exist in close up. It's and you have them for a moment, but they should be sparing in a Western. I think you really want to take advantage of the scope and the size of the locations you're in. And we talked a lot about utilizing silhouette and framing and what we wanted to say with, when we're utilizing extreme foreground and background, what does that mean and why, and our intentions for everything. And so we had really created a sort of visual language between the two of us that we're very happy with. And, when it came time for Bianca to come in and take this up in her stead, it was an enormous task because, there was a very specific kind of mulligan stew of lenses and lights and all that, and so Bianca and her team, they just painstakingly researched that, recreated the exact same packages. So we had all that to work with again. They watched everything just frame by frame by frame by frame. I don't think that Bianca and Helena were really all that far apart stylistically in the first place anyway. And so, yeah, we had, and then also, the gaffer from the first go around, Serge, was very helpful, and he gave, all his lighting notes, and we had access to all of Helena's notebooks and everything where she was just noting everything down. So we had about as much information as we possibly could for Bianca. And then, it's a matter of trying to preserve every frame humanly possible, even when, like you said, there are actors that didn't return. There were times when it's like, yeah, we'll be over the shoulder of one character, and then you turn around and you're in a different state, in a different town, in a different kind of light temperature and everything. But, they were able to make those moments seamless, and I kind of defy people to identify them really. I don't think there's any moment in the movie where you go, oh, that bumps, and there's a weird switch over there. I mean, It's all very, very seamless. We also had an absolute genius colorist in Natasha Leonette, and she was amazing. I still can't believe to this day that we got her. And so we had some really talented people doing some things. We also did a little, there's a little digital trickery here and there. There's some things that were shots I just couldn't bear to lose. So we said, well, how do we, so we'll just, yank one kid's head off digitally and stick another one on there, and do that kind of thing. And those moments are, again, I think they're pretty seamless. It's just about picking your spots and knowing what's going to work on, not some kind of studio budget.
You've made a piece, piece of art here, and I know that it sucks to always have to kind of couch it with the events of what happened around it. But one thing, I think we've acknowledged, the question that most people will have going into this, the why of it, and it makes sense to me. And so I'd like to focus before we move on from Russ just a little bit on the movie itself. And the one thing that I want to kind of point out, especially since this is a Stephen King show, is that the kind of the skeleton of this film, the thing that everything else hangs on, is one of my favorite Western tropes, and that is the grizzled old killing, bastard that has to, protect a kid, which, anybody who's a Stephen King fan and maybe ventured into the Dark Tower might recognize that King pulled elements from, True Grit or Three Godfathers or, any of these, classic Westerns that have that as the bit Shane, it's like,
Shane's a big one for me.
So it's like, I know it's not easy to get a Western made anyway, but what was the, during the origins of this, when was the decision to kind of go on that side? Because I think that most people, when they make a Western now, they either try to maybe imitate more of a Wild Bunch kind of, new Western or a spaghetti Western, but kind of that, John Ford classic Western seems to not be at the forefront, whenever the rare Western does get made these days. So maybe you can talk a little bit on that.
My way into Westerns as a kid was through my grandfather. My grandpa loved, and my uncles, and my uncle Jack, and my grandpa Joe Souza, and they loved Westerns, and they were always watching old John Wayne Westerns. I'd go over, there'd be the Sons of Katie Elder on, or Flintick, which is, they still, I think they play that a lot still on Easter for some reason. So that was kind of my way in, and they were, they read every Louis L'Amour novel and all those. So I think I always had more of an appreciation for the old school Westerns, like, Shane and the Searchers, obviously. We do some doorway stuff in this movie, and there's very specific reasons why. And
It's super wide and
I was also enormously, influenced by Unforgiven, and it might be trite, but it's, to, because it's such an obvious pull for people. It's such a But for me, it's the best Western ever made. It's my favorite.
Yeah, it's a towering work. Like
It
everything
is and it
you can't avoid either referencing it or being influenced by it, even if it's in trying not to be Unforgiven.
And I mean, to me, it's almost a perfect movie. And I don't know if you've ever read the script by David Peoples, but it's like one of the best scripts I've ever read by a mile, because it's fun to read. It's like there are certain scripts you read and they're like reading stereo instructions with good dialogue, but like Peoples has nice prose. Like, it's like Walter Hill. Walter Hill scripts are super fun to read because they're so amazingly written. And this was like that. It's just one of the best things I've ever read in my life, script or no script. And so that was on my mind a lot. And then, other things, like No Country is always a touchstone for me. And it, There Will Be Blood and things like that, and Days of Heaven, and all those. And it's like, it's funny. I always thought if I was going to make a Western, I'd make a Western like Silverado, which was just two-fisted fun adventure. But when I would sit down to write it, it just kind of, none of that came out. It was much more about exploring kind of consequences of violent acts and these things that ripple throughout generations. And but I always wanted to, I'd always sort of said, I want to make one for my grandpa. I want to make a movie for our grandpas that they would appreciate. And so that was always, that's the original genesis of it. And it obviously went through a lot of permutations over time. As you, I think when it started, I was originally going to have it be a father-son movie instead of a grandfather-grandson movie. But eventually it kind of turned into that when it was clear it was going to be Alec Baldwin, and it made more sense for him to be a grandpa there. But yeah, it was always more to me about like my grandpas and my uncles, and their names are all over the movie, by the way.
Oh,
Like,
really?
my uncle Herb Santis has got a sign, and you know, my uncle Jack's got the saloon, and my grandpa's got a like a mercantile, and my mom's got a brothel. My wife and mother-in-law have a dress shop, and my sons have things. My mom's got a great sense of humor, so it's smart to do that. Yeah.
I'd hope so for your sake.
I mean, you know, it's interesting with this movie. I think people are surprised when they see it. I think I've never met anybody who's seen it and had it. They're like, oh, this is exactly what I thought it was. I think people always thought it was some kind of like programmer geezer teaser, and it was never going to be that. It was never intended to be that. People always, yeah, I was very happy with the script, and I'm very happy with how the movie turned out. So.
So many Westerns are about this notion of justice versus survival. Like, what are you doing for yourself, and what is the right thing to do? What is the fair thing to do? And those two things are in conflict when you're in a place where it's not guaranteed you're going to make it to tomorrow. You might starve, you might get killed, you might die from the heat. Like, there's just, it's a desperate place, the old West,
Yeah, it doesn't want you there,
any
right?
frontier,
The West doesn't
right?
want you there. The land doesn't want you on it, right? And
No.
then there's like, you know, and everyone's out for themselves, and there's really very few things that are illegal, and there's no real sort of government infrastructure to carry you or help you or be a net for you. And it's, you know, you're really on your own out there. People are, you know, live to a ripe old age of 42, you know?
And in this case, in Rust, the Alec Baldwin character is he's a killer. He's an outlaw, a bank robber. He's been on the run, hiding out for years, decades, right? And yet he's the one who comes back to stop what everybody seems to recognize as some kind of injustice. This kid is being prosecuted and sentenced to death, and he's a kid. And it seems, I don't want to give away too much about what happens in the movie, but it seems like everybody, including Frances Fisher, who plays his sort of aging, wealthy aunt, thinks this is wrong, but nobody really knows how to stop it, except the guy who doesn't give a shit about the
Yeah, what I like about one of the things I was pleased with when I sort of finished the script for Rust, I'm like, oh, there's no moment in the movie where Rust identifies to himself why he's doing it. Like, I don't believe people in reality operate that way. And I tend to sort of write, I like to write sort of repressed blue collar guys who don't have handy access to their emotional states. And so they couldn't put into words why they're doing things, but they're motivated by things they can't explain. And they wouldn't know how to explain it if they did anyway. And so I think I'm glad that we don't sort of have that moment where he looks at you and is like, this is the only good thing I've ever done. You know, it's like, well, we get that. You know, you say it, you know.
I don't know if you're a reader of the Dark Tower series, Joel, but Eric is one of the world's experts in
Oh
it. And
God. Not even close, but I appreciate the compliment.
I mean, I know King's work, and even I'm like, wow, Eric knows a lot about the Dark Tower. Like, it sticks with him. But in the series, the gunslinger, sort of this, he was Idris Elba in the movie version, but sort of a man with no name, a Clint Eastwood type. Who ends up paired up with this boy named Jake. And the notion of the grizzled old guy who's lethal in the extreme and the innocent boy that he has to protect or not is like, Eric, what's that? How does that play out? Do you see any parallels, I guess, between you've seen Rust now? Like,
Oh yeah.
the Alec Baldwin thing with a kid, the gunslinger in King's work is so rough with a kid too. Like, he's not a coddling, nurturing figure.
Well, I mean, one of the first conversations that the kid and the grizzled man in your story have, he ends up with the man slapping the kid, and you know, which is a very John Wayne, you know, way to, you know, you don't back talk the elders in that time. That's just not how that happens. Especially when he just saved your life and put a giant price on his head by doing so. I'd say that the things that, I mean, I got a little bit more of the True Grit vibe, I think, than Dark Tower. But one of the things that did strike me about the middle of the movie is that what happens in the Dark Tower is Jake changes Roland's heart to a degree. And you can't, you know, and you can't help but not find that beat in the story. Not that, you know, he's suddenly a good guy, as you said,
Yeah.
but you see him soften, you see him, you know, they bond, and there is a paternal thing there. And even though Jake in the Dark Tower has a father, an asshole father, you know, back home, like he feels more at home and more protected by, you know, this menacing stranger, missing fingers and always
Yeah.
pissed off, you know, but every both of them get like a little bit of moment where you like you see, you know, under different circumstances maybe what they would the you know the life they would leave if he could settle down. Like you get these
Yeah.
glimpses of normal family man out of this, which is very much the Roland Jake relationship. So yeah, of course, I can't help but see Dark Tower wherever I look. So yeah, so I find it here.
It's interesting too because you know, there was, I'll be frank, there was like a little pushback against that. You know, I think there's this sort of leading man syndrome, right? Where it's like, no, I don't kick the dog, I pet him, and I kid put the kid up on my shoulder, and it's okay, Buster, and I love you. And it's like, no. So there was a lot of like sort of push and pull there with that, like the
Between you
slap
and Baldwin,
chicken.
like,
Yeah, it's like, no, it's like, but you know, look, it's the leading man thing. They're a leading man, they're the hero, and this and that. I'm like, no, you gotta like, and he came to understand it, obviously, but it's like, no, you gotta like, you're rough with this kid. You don't know what to do with a kid. It's like, you know, an abominable snowman trying to pick up a kitten with oven mitts on. It's kind of like,
Right.
you know, like, what am I doing? And he just doesn't know what to do with this kid. And again, he's like, it doesn't functionally change who he is when he decides to come get this kid. He's still like an old bastard, you know? So, but I tried to, yeah, like when it was important to have moments where like Russ softens toward him a little bit, but I try to do it just more with a look. Like he sees the kid doing this, and it's, and just like those looks can go a really long way when you have someone who can deliver one, right?
I think I know there, and it's a scene that I clocked too. I won't go into too much detail because it is kind of in the middle back half of the movie. But there's a scene when the kid, who has been so dependent on, well, he starts off very independent. You see, he's essentially running the house. He's raising his little brother. Parents are gone, like all that stuff, which also reminded him, like, is this what happened, you know, with Clint Eastwood's kids and Unforgiven? Because that people
Yeah,
always
we stayed with them, right?
forget
Yeah.
about that. It's like Clint Eastwood goes, "All right, you know, 8-year-old, look after your sister. I'm going to be gone on
Yeah.
a killing
Yeah.
mission for 3 weeks. Have fun with, you know, don't forget to feed the hogs."
Yeah.
So you see him very independent, but then he becomes very childlike, you know, when the murder happens, right? And he's kind of at the whims of everybody. And then when Rust picks him up, he's very dependent. He hates him. He wants to get away from him, but he's also realizes very soon that this guy is a guy you want protecting you if
Yeah.
you're going to have somebody protecting you. But he has a moment where he's kind of confronted with some natives
Yeah.
and I think that's the scene where you see him start to act like an adult and he figures a way out of the situation that doesn't involve killing,
Yeah.
right? And there's something, the fact that that resonates with Rust is really interesting because this is a man who, that's his default. That's his any
Yeah.
problem,
Yeah.
kill his way out of it. And to see, you know, there's a moment, you know, that you kind of linger on Baldwin there where he's like, he shows that he's impressed by what this kid, you know, his line of thinking. So that is probably one of my favorite like little moments in the movie, and I think it gives it a depth that, you know, again, you know, maybe I prejudged the movie. Again, the only thing I really knew about the movie going into it was all the controversy stuff and all
Yeah.
the, you know, all the shit that has nothing to do with the story, right? And so, you know, I think that for a lot of people, you know, that's just gonna have to be a mountain that you're gonna have to climb with this, because that's just, you know, how people know the movie and they prejudge the movie. And I think everybody's guilty of that, no matter how even minded they are. But you know, I think ultimately the strengths of the movie will, you know, will stand and they'll be there, you know. And you know, I so, you know, I don't know. This is a long rambling way of saying that I think I know what moment you're talking about, and I think it's moments like that that might survive the current reputation of the movie.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You know, it's one thing I set out to do with the movie, and it's always sort of gratifying when you have an intention and then by the end of the thing, it sort of manages to survive because it's not always easy.
Right.
But I wanted it to be sort of clear that, you know, you have this kid, and there are sort of three primary male characters that hover around him in for the rest of the movie. There's his grandfather, who's this sort of murderous outlaw, but is trying to do the right thing. There's the marshal, who by all sort of standards, you'd think he's a sort of the upright hero, but he's really not, and he's sort of a coward in a lot of ways. And then
He's
there's this,
hunting a kid like
yeah.
he's
But he's also
he
like in his own personal life, he's cowardly,
yeah
right?
yeah
And then there's this just psychopathic,
bounty
preacher
hunter.
character who's Fimmel, who just, God, he's so, I love Fimmel. He plays everything between the beats. He's so great.
His
But
name, for people who don't know, his name is, they call him the preacher because he quotes the Bible all the
he
time,
just
but he's a
wears
bounty
people
hunter.
out just by
He's a bounty
bullshitting
hunter,
people
right?
so frequently about the Bible stuff. And so, but like these three characters are potential, like Lucas is a 13-year-old kid with no supervision or anything. It's like he could end up to be like his grandfather. He could end up to be like the preacher. He could end up to be like Wood, Helm, the marshal. And sort of, what I try to hope, what I hope is that people sort of glean is that the kid is actually his own man and a better man than any of those other three at 13. He's his own person.
He is, and as Eric said, he's independent, but he's not competent because he's a kid.
He's failing. Like he's trying to raise his brother on this failing little farm, and it's not working. It's like there's a brick wall at some point for them.
One of my favorite details in Rust is you see the grave silhouetted against the sun. Again, another beautiful piece of cinematography. The two graves for his parents, and the mother's is, it's got that sort of oval shape, and it's
A proper headstone, yeah.
intricately carved, and it's clear she died first, and that the father made this. And then when he died, his grave is marked by like just two sticks nailed together. Like that's how a kid buries their parent.
Yeah, I think the way I described it in the script was it had the father's name, but written off the end of it, like the way a kid writes off the end of a paper and runs out of space.
Like right there, that just tells you everything you need to know. Is this was a functioning farm, but this kid's trying, but yeah, it's not. The Marshall character, that brings us back to a death in the Stephen King short story we're going to talk about. There is a Sheriff Barclay, who's the, I guess you'd call him the main character in this. Jim Truesdale is the sort of, I don't know, sort of scrubby weirdo who lives on the outskirts of town that they accuse of this heinous murder of a young girl. They're trying to find the silver dollar that he would have taken from her because he killed her on her birthday. She had this coin. And the sheriff in this story reminds me of your Marshal Helm in that he's just trying, man, he's beaten down. He just wants to do the right thing. He doesn't know what's right. And he really questions whether this guy is guilty or not.
No, there's that great line in there where he, this short story is so different from other Stephen King things. It's so spare and sparse in how it's written. And he gives you these nuggets that, especially when you go back on a second read, you go, oh, he was telling me the whole time. Like there's this great line where he says, there hasn't been a hanging here in 10 years, and I just hope to God there's not one for another 10 years.
And I'll
And
be
it's
gone
just
by then.
everything about that character, about what weighs on him. And but he's so sort of economical with his language in this. I mean, it's funny. It occurred to me last night as I reread it, I'm like, you could tell me, had I never read this and didn't know who wrote it, you could tell me, oh, there's this undiscovered prologue to No Country for Old Men. Read it. Because it's like that could have been a prologue for that.
Which,
The
King
character.
is never accused of writing sparsely, so for him to take that Cormac McCarthy approach, I love it when King does that though, because he does that. You can tell, especially with a lot of his short stories, he just views them as like, I'm gonna have fun experimenting in this style. Sometimes it's more of the was it called a apothecary? Is that the No, that's like a that's like apothecary is like where you go to get medicine and shit in the Old West, right? What's the style like Dracula or whatever, where you're writing it like journals? It's something. There's a word like that. Now I sound old.
Epistolary.
Epistolary.
There we go.
Yes.
E, not an A there.
Yeah.
So, you know, he'll do that with like Jerusalem's Lot, you know. I mean, he wrote Carrie that way. So, you know, he'll do that with his novels too, but I love it when he gets very excited to play in different voices. And, you know, and you can see him perk up about it. A lot of his crime fiction is that way, where you can tell he's playing in a different way. And speaking of, there's lots of things in the story I want to point out feel to me like a test run for The Outsider, by the way.
Oh,
So
interesting. But he told us in our interview with him earlier this year, he's a really good mimic. And I think that's true. I think he can, his style in The Dark Tower is very different than any of his other novels, the crime novels. He's so clearly channeling John D. MacDonald in those Mr. Mercedes books. And this one, A Death, is dedicated to Elmore Leonard. And I was picking up vibes of I don't know if you guys read the ever read The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane. That reminds me a lot of this story too, just in the style of it, the very Spartan approach to language and the sort of regret of like, I don't want to have to kill you. Like, I don't want this.
This
Nobody
very much
wants
could have been an
this.
Elmore Leonard story, though.
Yeah, so
Been, I mean,
you're an
it's funny.
Elmore Leonard fan, right?
I'm not a big bucket list guy, but I said before I croak, I'm going to have read every single thing Elmore Leonard ever wrote. And I'm probably about three quarters of the way there at this point. I'm right now. I'm on the. I was on a big Western kick. Right now, I'm sort of halfway through The Hunted. But you know, it's sort of his Israeli crime flick or crime story. But yeah, it's very, you know. It's very 310 to Yuma. It's very spare. It's very sparse. You know, the characters, it's so well done, especially like when you go back on second look, it's like, you know, you realize how careful he was with every word he used in subverting your expectations and subverting not only about like sort of crime and punishment and justice and guilt and innocence, but also in storytelling and in Western storytelling. And he plants all these seeds for you to just know that this man is being railroaded. You know it in every fiber of your being that this man's being railroaded. And not just in the obvious ways by having people like shout, "Hang that bastard," in court. And things like the way he, like when he tells, when Barclay catches Truesdale crying, he tells him to wipe his nose and he wipes his nose. You're now thinking this man's simple just by that simple thing of he wipes his nose. And it's just so incredible. And you know,
That he
you're
has to
sort
be
of
told to
given.
wipe his nose, right? Like
Yeah, and you're
that's
given a little bit of a glimpse into like the sheriff's sort of inner life just through his dialogue, but Truesdale's dialogue is so sort of flat and matter of fact that you never, he never sort of makes any kind of inference or implication rather to his guilt, so you believe he must be innocent because he's simple. And why else would they be telling me this story unless it was another situation, a John Coffey situation or something like, you know, and then by the end, you just like the whole like when I read it a second time, I'm like, man, this is like a stick in my eye. He like literally just stuck a stick in my eye with this thing. Like, you know, the sheriff says we were all, I was a, the sheriff wasn't a fool. I'm a fool. Like Stephen King is telling me, the reader is the fool for falling for it.
It King has said that the origins of this story were he was going to sleep one night and he pictured a man in darkness sitting beside a fire. And then that became these other men gathered around him, and then he starts telling the story. And that's where it picks up, is this guy, Truesdale, is sitting around a fire. He's sort of vaguely reading or seems a little nervous, seems a little agitated. And Truesdale shows up with a posse, and they're like, talk about like his flat affectation. The sheriff is just like, hey man, where's your hat? Like the hat becomes a clue. That's the thing that ties him to this murder, is they find his distinctive hat near the body.
But even
And
that they're playing with him with the hat, right? They're sort of just trying to, they know where the hat is. They're just playing with him. And so you think, oh, they're manipulating this simple man. And then, you know, and then when, you know, there's that great line when they're during the court proceedings where he says, and that's when Truesdale knew that, or Barclay knew that Truesdale was innocent.
Yeah,
He
it's a pretty
pushes
short
you over the
story.
edge with that.
You know, he can write a short story that starts to feel like a novella, you know, but this one it stays pretty tight, and Truesdale gets put on trial. He's in, you know, it's not a contemporary crime story, so the trial doesn't last a year. It's it's like a couple of weeks, but he's detained. And one of the details I found really like really painful is, even while he's on trial, they're building the gallows.
Yeah.
So like, which they can hear the
very
hammering.
Flippantly too. Yeah, they're very sort of flippant about the language, about how they discuss the gallows. A kid could do it. It's so easy, you know?
It's so easy. Like, this is the easiest job. Yeah. And, you know, while he's on trial, he can hear them building the gallows. It's sort of like, and it's a point of the story that nobody in town has any doubt that this guy is guilty.
Right.
And for the sheriff.
And he is being railroaded. It's like this trial, the outcome is predetermined.
The prosecutor is the judge, for God's sake.
Yep.
But like, there's that brilliant thing where the king does, where he talks about like the flair the prosecutor has, and he has an eye for the ladies, and you're thinking, oh, that son of a bitch. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's just gradually building this brick wall of your distrust of these other characters.
Right.
He gets into the biology of death too. At one point, it's kind of an icky part of the story, and I hope it doesn't turn people off of reading it. But like, the sheriff brings this guy in and makes him take off all his clothes, sees where there are no holes in his pocket. There's a hole in his boot, but not big enough that the silver dollar could have slipped out if that was where he stashed it. And then he looks up his ass. Like, he makes him bend over and does a cavity search.
Oh, he describes the pop.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those details. Like, Steve, Uncle Steve, come on.
What I love about that is I saw in that movie I did, Crown Vic, I have Tom Jane do that to a guy on the side of a road.
Oh, yeah.
there's this great actor I love named Devin Werkheiser. He's in Rust also. He plays one of the shit kicker brothers. Mm-hmm. And he's brother to Reese Coiro in that. But, the character is this lowlife in Crown Vic, and the cop takes him off the side of the road, and he's selling drugs, and he's sort of had a history with them, and he says, take off your shoes. And the guy goes, oh, I've already been searched. And he goes, oh, you've been searched. So he makes him stand up, take all his clothes off on the side of a busy road, and spread his ass apart in front of traffic. He goes, no, you were patted down. Now you've been searched. See the difference? That moment is such a, and even there's, when he talks about what happened, when he hangs and the sort of the piss dripping down.
That's what I was going to get to next, is that, the notion of like a guy dying and peeing is so, that's sort of a stereotype and cliche. Mm-hmm. But in this, it's just, he describes, it works because he goes, it's snowing and there are a couple of yellow drops in the snow beneath him. Mm-hmm. And
in Rust, we did a sequence where he hangs somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid watches it because the kid's escaped his own hang, and he sees us hanging, and it's a very emotional thing for him to see. But when we filmed it, I had the guy who gets hanged, we had run some hoses down through his legs, and we had him piss himself and then shit himself.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the shit running down the leg of his pants and down into the ground while he's kicking and flaying around. And on set, when we did it, some of the crew people were gagging.
Right.
I remember looking at that and going, oh, I wonder if we took this a step too far. And then when I put it together, it played comically.
Mm. Right.
Like a Dumb and Dumber kind of thing.
Yeah. Like... I'm like, no. We can't. That did not. Yeah. We're going to have to lose that. Yeah.
What do you substitute for those fluids?
I think the piss was Mountain Dew, if memory serves. And,
carbonated piss.
There's a great old on the old Dana Carvey show. They did a live ad for Mountain Dew once in that show's glorious brief run. And Dana Carvey's going, you know what this looks like, right? Oh, you know what this looks like. Commercial for Mountain Dew, but no. And then it was canned dog food pumped through a hose. Otherwise, but it just it did. It played very like Farrelly Brothers, and I'm like, no, we can't. This is not.
Whoops.
Yeah, forgive the direct on the nose about it, but gallows humor is a thing and kind of could be needed to offset some seriousness sometimes. But kind of the whole point of that scene is the kid has been a little, he's been scared, but like, and he's been curious about what a hanging would be because he knows that's, what's in his future if he's ever caught. And then he sees it and it becomes real. And so, it sounds like it would make, it makes sense for you not to take it up a notch at that moment, because then that kind of undercuts what the kid is seeing there.
Yeah. It takes it out of the abstract for him, right? Like, it's no longer like what could happen. It's, oof.
The best gallows scene I've ever seen in a movie was the Coen brothers' True Grit. Simply because of the moment where, like, there's, one guy who's sort of lamenting his family being alone, and the other guy's just like, I just killed the wrong guy. But then, like, the Native American begins to talk, and they literally just stick a bag over his head, just like that. I'm like, that's just such brilliant storytelling,
They had another one in, what was that, the Ballad of Buster
Oh,
Scruggs? That's the
right.
one
That's
that's been
been
first
memed to
time.
death. Yeah, first
Yeah,
time.
first time.
Your first time? Yeah, it's a great,
Well, Truesdale, when he finally gets to the gallows, I thought that was pretty upsetting too, because he's really like almost reverts to a childlike state of like begging and pleading. And he's been pretty, I don't know, almost, I don't know if stoic is the right word, but just almost like he doesn't understand what's happening, even on trial, where they sentence him to death and like, do you have anything to say? And he's like, I don't know, I can't think of anything. Like, and then he's
No, that
begging
went a
for
very
them.
different direction than I thought it was going to go.
Where did you
I
expect it?
assumed that the character would still sort of stay stoic through it and kind of dumbstruck through it, and it's upsetting, and
He's begging, like, please don't put a hood over my head. Let me look at
it's
the
very
mountains.
childlike. Please let me look at the mountains. If I'll be good, he says, I'll be good. He
Again,
just
very John
like,
Coffey. Don't put me in the dark.
yeah. And it's like, but when you know how the story resolves and you look at that, you think, yeah, it really was. He really was just sort of, he was never going to own up to it. And you don't understand quite why. He is very stupid. It's not like he was hiding something from people, that hiding some brilliance or some brilliant criminal mind. Maybe he did convince himself he didn't do it. It's like, it's very interesting. It's the character's such a, like a cipher. He's just such a null. It's like you fill him with all your expectations and about the conventions of storytelling, right? It's like, oh, that poor man. That poor, poor man. It's like if, Lardass really was a bastard in Stand By Me,
From Stand By
right?
Me, yeah. Maybe this is a good point to warn our listeners, if you haven't read A Death and you want to check it out, pause our show here and now let can we get into the spoilers and the ending of the story and the interpretation of it? So come back if you haven't read it. If you have, sally forth with us. But do you guys consider this to be a murder mystery, this story?
Not really. No.
I mean, there's elements. You can definitely say there's elements, but yeah, that's not the feeling I get, where you're trying to,
Like a
even something like
whodunit.
The Outsider is more of a how did he not do it, right? Like, right from the beginning, you're like, how did he not? We need to prove how this guy didn't do it, which has a little bit more of that murder mystery feel. But this one, no, like, the feeling that I got from it more than anything was just about the Barkley character, just like, wrestling with his own preconceptions and convincing himself. So I mean, maybe to him it's a murder mystery where he's trying to
He want
convince himself, but
you think he just wants to believe this guy didn't do it because he hasn't seen this kind of thing and doesn't want to believe it's
well,
possible.
it's that little self-doubt moment where it's just like, all right, well, it's pretty obvious that this guy did it, but we don't have that silver dollar. Whoever has that silver dollar is the murderer, and we haven't found it. And that one little, like, since we haven't found it, like, can I really believe that this man would have killed this girl? And it's like I don't know. Like, I think that that's one of my favorite things about The Outsider too, is the Ralph Anderson character, who's so sure at the beginning and slowly has that eaten away throughout, the novel.
And you said earlier you feel like this is like a test run, like he was warming up for the in
Very
outside.
much, very much so, with a completely different outcome. Because spoiler alert, Truesdale did it. And we find out at the very end where the silver dollar was. Do you want to illuminate the people?
Well, I'll start by saying, I don't know how you feel, Joel. Is that your sense of it too?
I would say it feels allegorical to me, but I'm not clear on the moral of the story.
I disagree with you, Eric. I
Interesting.
don't think I think Truesdale is innocent.
Oh, interesting.
And I think there are clues about what happened, but I think Truesdale is not guilty. That's my verdict. But we can get into why.
Oh,
So,
please. This is going to be a big debate here.
yeah.
It's interesting because, to me, the what make That would recontextualize the story and what I like about the story. And I like that kind of gut punch when he, you know, when he had convinced so thoroughly convinced himself that this guy was innocent, and then going like, you, where that leaves somebody going, if I can be convinced that this dude was innocent when he wasn't, what else am I not getting right in this world? You
I think
know?
that's the tension of the story. I think that's all in there. But I think he is not the sheriff isn't is hoodwinked at the end of this.
Oh, okay. Yeah, please.
So he shows up, he goes to the bar where Truesdale had his drink and claims he left his hat, right? Or that's where his hat disappeared and ended up by this body. Who's sitting in there having a glass of wine, which to me reads like, I think that's symbolic. I think there's something like the drinking of blood, because faith is such a big thing. It ends with the sheriff walking away and he hears the doxology. That's the hymn that's like, what is it like? Praise God from whom all blessings flow. You know, like that. We've all heard that song. Like it's this sort of haunting melody about having faith in God and Christ and all that. And so here's this. I think his name is Hines, the mortician, who's sitting in that very bar having a glass of wine. So to me, that seems a little vampiric, right? He's this creepy, you know, morticians are generally, you know, unusual people, let's say.
Was wine
He's
common in the Old West there? What
no.
it's you go in for beer, right? That's the
Yeah. Very. So
beer or
that's why I think
whiskey?
it's unusual. Like there's whiskey, there's tequila. You remember the Three Amigos? They
Of
go in and
course.
they're like, hey,
Is there
tequila. Yeah, he's like, he's like
beer?
here. But he says, come here, I want to show you something. And takes him to his I don't know, what do you call where a mortician works? His lab, his
The mortuary?
the mortuary, the room where he embalms the body
The
or
ice
buries the body.
house?
Yeah, and he shows him the silver dollar, which he says Truesdale. We know, like, I was like, why is Steve having this guy put a finger up this dude's butt at the beginning of the story? Like, was that necessary? And it is necessary because he has to prove that it's not hidden there. And true, and basically, Hines says it was hidden there. He would swallow it. And every time, and then the sheriff is like, but he, you know, he was in custody for weeks. And I clean, and King makes the point that he's pooping into a bucket. And he's like, so I would clean out the bucket. And it was never there. And he goes, well, he kept swallowing it again. And I'm like, I just don't buy that. You know, the guy was dumb, but he wasn't like an animal. So he wasn't like covered in shit in this jail cell, which he would have been. There's no way to clean up, right? And I think the mortician did it. I think Hines killed her, took the dollar. Realize this is gonna, I'm gonna have to plant this on the guy. Because also, the other clue is in the very beginning, when they show up, when the posse shows up to Truesdale's little house, there are four on horseback and two on the seat of an old buckboard with Hines Mortuary
Where,
printed
yeah.
on the side in faded yellow letters. The mortician was there, like saying, oh, hey, look, like, let's go get this guy. We'll take my wagon. Like he was already pinning it on this dude. So I don't think it's definite. I'm not saying it's 100%, but my suspicion is the mortician killed
Well, I am an expert on assholes. And so I
her.
will say that if he's swallowing the coin, it's not going to be up there for the cavity search, my man. That'll be sitting in the,
No.
it was sitting somewhere in his intestines, probably. And I don't know, there's something super gross about the idea of continually eating the evidence out of your poop
Yeah.
that I think is very juvenile, fun
Yeah.
king bullshit. So
So you
I
take it at
maybe I'm
face
taking a little
value.
bit more. I'm taking it at face value. I think that's what makes the most sense to me. But I do love that there is this now little seed of doubt that's very true to the story now. There's this little seed of doubt in the back of my mind. You're gonna turn me into this. You're gonna turn me into the fucking marshal in this story.
Well, maybe the debate is the point, right? Maybe this is the spinning top and the briefcase full of shininess at the end of it. It's but yeah, no, I would think, what occurred to me when the mortician is talking about, yeah, he'd get this silver dollar out, clean it off, and swallow it again. And why that worked for me and why that made me believe that that is what happened is because the guy was an idiot, and he was just a, he didn't know what else to do with it. He couldn't hide it anywhere. He couldn't put it on his, he just kept swallowing it because he couldn't think of what else to do with it. But he was so desperate to hide it that that's all he could do with it.
All right.
But yeah, there are things like the wine is strange. That's
Yeah,
very
and
specific.
you don't make that choice as Stephen King to have him sitting amongst all these hard drinkers and this guy's just drinking wine.
That's not an accident.
So, but also, all right, hear me out. When would he have swallowed this coin? Because if he had the coin and these guys show up, he's kind of caught off guard. He doesn't swallow it then. Did he swallow it before they got there? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
That's true. I mean, there is also a thing, he makes reference to being worried about what's inside him when he hangs, right? When he
Yeah.
eats.
Well, he says, he eats his last meal of steak and eggs or whatever, and he's like, it occurs to me like when I die, I'm gonna just I'll never digest this. Like I'll never,
So
what does he say?
digestion is clearly on his mind.
I'll never pass it through. But it's sad. But it's like,
But then
oh,
that,
this
see, to
is.
me, that feeds the idea that he ate the coin.
You think that he's gonna think, oh, now you'll know I'm guilty because, or he would think, you won't know I'm guilty because he's not aware that he's gonna empty his bowels anyway,
Yeah, I
right?
don't,
So he wouldn't worry about that. He'd be like, oh yeah, it's just gonna stay stuck inside of me.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is, maybe my interpretation of the whole story in general is when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. It was so obvious that he did it, but I love that he plants very subtle seeds of doubt,
Well, you also have to look at him, ask yourself if he did do it, why is even up to the moment that he's hanging, does he refuse to own up to it or whatever? And so maybe he's embarrassed by the fact that he got caught at something. And so when you're that embarrassed by it and you just refuse to look it in the eye and acknowledge what you did, like he would do anything to keep that little piece of evidence from, a secret so people weren't validated in their hatred of him. You know what I
And he
mean?
also doesn't make it easy on you. He gives you a character that is sort of, there's echoes of Tom Chaney and echoes of Anton Chigurh in a way, and just that there is no emotion there. He plays it, it is so sort of flat and devoid of any emotion that you don't really, like I said, you're just sort of left to fill him with your impressions and your expectations,
Also, I just checked after he hangs, there are yellow drops in the snow. There's no brown drops. So
Silver dollar
that silver dollar plops out and
plugging
drops
him
down his
up.
pants. But
That's if you're adapting it into a movie, it just you then you get Joel's original ending, and so
Yeah, that's
somebody
what I
gets hit in the
mean.
head with a
That's
diarrhea coin.
the interesting thing too, in talking about, and I was telling you this the other day, Anthony, it's like, Stephen King books to me, a lot of them very quickly, like everything. Since I was a kid, anything I read, it's just I can't help it. I view it. Could this be a movie? Could this be a movie? And so Stephen King books, in like the first paragraph if there's a movie. And with A Death, the first line, I knew it was a movie. I'm like, oh, this is a movie. The first just description of him sitting there, I'm like, this is a movie. And it's very, very clear and obvious to me. And I like, I'm such a big Elmore Leonard fan, but those are never clear to me till I finish the book. Like they're, books I read and I'll get all the way through, something and I'll be like, man, it's like, could Road Dogs be a movie? Like, could it? And it's never clear, but I mean, Scott Frank is sort of the only one who really, ever successfully cracked that. I mean, and I wouldn't say, I mean, not that 310 to Yuma isn't an incredibly good, but it's such a short story, whereas Get Shorty and Out of Sight or, full novels, and Scott Frank was did a brilliant job of how he adapted those. But no, this one is like A Death could be a great movie, but it's so short and spare, you'd have to take great care not to lose its intention and lose its voice, and because you have to scale certain things up, and does it become a big investigation, and are you, how do you sort of fill between A and B? It would be an excellent movie though.
Well, I mean, I think that, the first time King came on the show, one of the questions that I threw at him was like, from his point of view, what was the secret to adapting his work? I'm a movie guy, grew up a movie guy more than the literary guy. And so, I've always been really fascinated by the process of adaptation. And I'm like, no, this guy's, if there's anybody that has insight into it, it's going to be Stephen King himself. He's written a huge chunk of his own adaptations and all this stuff. And I was expecting him to be like, okay, well, you need to find character, or you need to find the subtext. Yeah, I was expecting one of those. And he goes, the short stories tend to be good movies. And I'm just like, okay, that's a, you're exactly right. And I think he kind of leaned in on that space you're talking about that you have to fill in. It gives the filmmakers and storytellers a little room to expand, but also the fact that short stories, the best of them are set up almost like jokes, right? It's set up, set up execution and punchline, and so.
It's I was thinking, like, what would make this a great movie? What would make a death a great movie? And the answer I came up with was a time machine. Go back to 1987,
Oh.
so William Goldman could write it
Yes.
and
Yeah.
Rob Reiner could direct it.
Yeah.
It's like,
I was here the second you said that, I'm like, Back to the Future 3 it, huh? Okay. Oh, no. Okay.
yeah, we're gonna add that into the no, but
And then Doc jumps out and goes, "You can't kill him."
like, to me, those are my favorite King adaptations are, the adaptation of The Body in Misery.
Yeah.
And I mean, although I really, really do like what Muschietti did with it
Yeah, yeah,
a
yeah.
lot, but no, I was having this conversation about Rob Reiner with a friend the other day, and I'm like, I'll put his run between Stand By Me and A Few Good Men, or not Stand, I'm sorry, Spinal Tap and A Few Good Men against anybody's run ever in this business, ever. You
Yeah, it's
could
a good run.
extend it to the American president, but North is in the middle of that. So, but like, if you go from Spinal Tap, the sure thing isn't like legendary, but it's a really good movie. But then you go Stand By Me, you go Princess Bride, you go Misery, you go When Harry Met Sally, and you go A Few Good Men. Like,
It's a good run.
not only are these good movies, these are stone cold TBS rotation classics. Like, I mean, Spielberg obviously had his, stunt has had his astonishing run, and you can make that argument for a lot of people, but I'll put him up against anybody
Yeah.
with that run.
Well, and here's the thing, and we pointed this out on the show a bunch, especially in the early days. When you're kind of looking at the Rob Reiner stuff, he didn't just make great movies, he made the gold standards of their genre. There is no better coming of age movie than Stand By Me. There just isn't. There is no better fantasy, romance, storybook, fairy tale. Princess Bride is kind of like his Big Trouble in Little
Comedy.
China. There's just no nothing else. There is no better mockumentary than Spinal Tap. There is no better military courtroom drama, than A Few Good Men. There is no better rom-com than, When Harry Met Sally. It's
You
like
look at
that is
how
what
those
they all aspire to. He made the
no, those are the movies that you
drama.
use in pitch meetings.
Yeah, you're
Like
right.
it's this meets Stand By Me, or it's
Yeah.
Princess Bride meets John Wick, or whatever. It's
Yep.
like
I want to see
what
Princess
does one
Bride
have in
meets John
common?
Wick.
Yeah, what does
You
all
killed my
common?
dog. Prepare to
Yeah, I'm gonna copyright
die.
that before we get off the air. No, but it's what those movies had in common is he had brilliant writers.
Yeah.
You got a couple of Goldmans in there, you got a Sorkin, you got an Efron,
Yep.
you got
Yeah.
Guest, it's yeah.
The wild thing too is his relationship to another writer. Wait, why am I blanking on the guy who created All in the Family?
Oh,
Norman
Lear.
Lear. Norman Lear. Sorry, the name was like just outside my grasp for a second there. Obviously he was meathead on All in the Family. He knew Norman Lear, and the reason we have Stand By Me is because Rob Reiner got into financial trouble on it. Like the financing started to fall apart. He had it all lined up. And he went to Norman Lear and said, can you help me out? Can you invest in this? Can you support this picture? And Lear liked the prospect and he invested. I think that's why he's credited as a producer on it. And he's one of the owners of it. And Norman Lear controls I think he owns The Princess Bride. So, you know, when Jason Reitman did that, I don't know if you guys saw that thing where during pandemic they recreated The Princess Bride like on people's cameras and stuff. He had to get the blessing of Norman Lear and Rob Reiner himself. I interviewed Rob for for a piece I did about that project, and he was like, "Oh yeah, the reason Norman owns The Princess Bride is I got him to come aboard and help support Stand By Me." And then he said, "What else are you doing?" He's like, "Oh yeah, I got this Princess Bride, this William Goldman novel thing that I want to do." And he goes, "No, I'll buy that one too. Like I love like it's like sort of like shopping spree, you know."
Well,
But
Stand By Me is such like a
thank goodness Norman Lear wanted to support the arts, you know, support
Stand
those
By
two
Me is
stories.
such a, you know, and it's such a great novella. It's so conversational. I love just how it's just you're sitting next to somebody and telling you that it's that movie, that book is the most conversational, I think, of his that I've ever read. But and there's, you know, and there's a variation of the line in the movie, but there are lines that just haunt me. Like, you know, I've never had any friends later on in life like the ones I had when I was 12. Jesus, is anybody? It's like, it's just
That's fucking
that line
true.
put me in a mood for a week about my mourning my childhood, mourning my gone, my lost childhood. You know, it's and there's never been a movie or a story about being 12 that comes close to me. I mean, I guess the one that comes close, and it's a completely different kind of movie, is Tree of Life, where they accurately really get what it's like to be 12. You know, and but yeah, I remember Stand By Me. That was my intro to Stephen King as movies. Because I was, as a kid, I wasn't a big horror movie guy, and I was a little afraid of Stephen King stuff, even though I would watch, like, me and my buddy Len, we'd watch, like, Friday the 13th, because we just want to know how they did it. Like, we got the books and watched all behind-the-scenes movies and everything, but Stand By Me was my intro. I remember my friend breathlessly kind of running to me in junior high school going, "It's about us! It's about us!" Like, that was it. And that sort of got me into, and after that, I think the first thing I ever read from King was The Monkey.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Joel, we normally one of our intro questions is what's your King origin story? But we're saving that for the end here. What's
Yeah,
your
no,
King
it's,
origin story?
yeah, no, the, like I said, it was Stand By Me for movies, but I thought, oh, so it's not all sort of scary things, and I don't, you know, and it's not just The Shining, which, you know, I remember, and on TV, sort of walking in and just sort of seeing the two girls and just kind of backing slowly away and walking out. You
No,
know,
you
as a
noped out
kid,
of it. Yeah, I got you.
yeah,
So
I think I was
the
probably like 8 or 9 or something, you know.
mo
But The Monkey. So I just, somebody, a friend of mine, had a collection of short stories, and I read The Monkey in class one day, and you know, it just disturbed me. It didn't scare me. It's not per se a frightening story. I mean, he describes there's some trappings where he describes the monkey and the yellow teeth and the eyes, and but to me, it was just that. The way Hal kind of, and obviously it's much more deeply explored in The Shining, but the way Hal kind of deteriorates in his relationship with his wife, and he becomes unpredictable a little bit and a little harsh with them. And there's this sort of inner voice that, you know, the monkey's sort of talking to him. But even as like a 13-year-old, I'm like, I don't think the monkey's talking to him. I think this is in his head. And I had, you know, a lot of anxieties as a kid. I suffered from anxiety my whole life. And it just, like, when the monkey would talk, or this voice in his head, it reminded me of my own, like, what anxiety was like, this sort of rush of things at you. And that was my intro to King. And I think after that, I probably read, you know, The Body and stuff like that. But and eventually that, you know, led to The Stand, which led to, you know, The Shining, which led to Carrie, you know.
So have you read like Salem's Lot and like or any of his like 90s output? Because isn't
Not a
the
lot. I didn't read Salem's Lot, and I'll tell you why. Because the movie was on, and the kid at the window just scared me shitless.
Man, that comes up a
Just
lot
scared
in our
me
conversations.
shitless. That was, who was, that was, what's his name was in that movie? David
Soul.
Soul. But it, you know, let me, I was done out. Like, couldn't, that was the movie that made me afraid of Stephen King stuff.
The Glick Boy at
So
the
it just, I
window
never,
and the Tim Curry Pennywise in the sewer grate are
oh
like
my gosh. Like, look,
depending which generation you are, that's one of those two
yeah, the new, obviously the new version of it, I think, is a superior telling of the story, but Tim Curry as Pennywise, just, he's just off in the distance waving with the bullet. It's like, that is nightmare fuel forever, you know? And, you know, that was, I mean, I watched that. It was great. I didn't see the new version of The Stand. I haven't seen that.
They take a wild swing that doesn't work, which is unfortunate because it's cast really well. But what they do is they decide to change the structure around and do kind of that Lost style backwards and forwards thing, which completely kills the feeling of living in the post-apocalyptic world, which is kind of what is so incredible about that story and the humanity and what it does, when everything's gone. And you're just constantly like pulled into, to flashbacks, and it really just kind of, fucks with the whole point of the story and what I want out of an
It
adaptation.
starts, the world is already over and the guys are cleaning up, and it's like, and then you flash back to yeah, I really dislike that too. I don't
It's a
know
swing. It's
why.
and I'll give him that, but it doesn't work. Sometimes you take the
The movie
swing and
series was
you
Gary
whip it.
Sinise, right? The
Hmm?
first one, yeah. The
First
mini
one, the
series was Gary Sinise
Molly
and
Ringwald.
Rob Lowe.
Yep. He
Matt
was Nick.
Frewer was Trash Can, and he was
Yep.
Matt Frewer was freaky in that. He was
Yeah.
great.
Yeah, My Life for You, yes. Well, and then yeah, that's the other unfortunate is it's Ezra
Miller.
Miller is Trash Can Man in that, and he goes full on like height of his insanity, I guess. There
He
he I
takes a
mean it
swing.
just I mean we kind of joke about it, but it's like he kind of simple jacks it. Like he just goes way
Oh,
too far. He goes
God.
way too far. So
Well, now I have to watch it.
yeah, it's I mean li listen, it's something for a Stephen King fan, especially a fan of that book. It's really fascinating, but it's just a misfire. I mean, kind of you can kind of lump the Dark Tower movie into a similar category where I mean when you start to hear about what happened with the movie, and I remember I talked with the director about it before it came out, and he was devastated. He was the biggest Dark Tower fan in the world, and there's so many cooks in that kitchen, and he didn't, he tried to save what he could, and unfortunately, he didn't really carry much power on that production,
You
and
wind up with
yeah.
Judge Dredd, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, but I kind of view the same thing. It's like it's a wild swing. It's a giant mess. It doesn't work, but it is interesting, and it's kind of interesting to look back on it.
I kind of wish there was a way to remix it, the Stand series, the new one, and like straighten out the narrative and
Hey, look, they did that with Phantom Menace back in the day, right? I mean, there's some ambitious
Yeah, we got to get
viewer
Topher
out there
Grace
with a little
on
time on
this.
their hands.
Oh yeah, no, that was the Phantom edit. I
Yeah.
remember, rumors were going around that this thing existed, and I was working for the AP. Did you watch the Phantom edit when you were at Ain't It Cool, Eric?
I must have, yeah. Yeah, because
Like,
I was a dyed-in-the-wool prequel hater, so
but
yeah.
this was like
Yeah.
1990. This was 2000. So like, I don't think I had a DVD player then. Everything was VHS,
Yeah.
and I
Did
had to
you have your
find a.
laser disc player at the time?
I had to find a copy of the Phantom Edit, and I went to like a comic shop here in LA on Ventura Boulevard, and I hit up the guy at the counter, and I was like, "Do you know anything about this?" It was like those old cop movies where where
Just
Frank
looking
Drebin
around.
goes to talk to
You a
the
cop?
shoeshine guy, and it's like,
You have
"Hey,
to
what do
tell
you
me
know
if you're a
about?"
cop.
Yeah,
Yeah,
the guy
you have
was
to
like,
tell me.
"Oh no, I don't know anything about that." I think he was like, I think every people were really worried about like Lucasfilm like sending agents out into the field to find this thing.
Which,
And
by the way, that's not an irrational fear because people forget this now. And the gold, the rose-colored Lucas era thing, he actually raided conventions and like stole people's
really?
like if they were selling like the movie posters or
Or
whatever,
the Christmas
oh really?
special or
Christmas
whatever. I didn't
special.
know
Like
that.
he and like organized the FBI to raid the fans to make sure they didn't have the shit he didn't want
Hopefully,
out there.
Hardware
Yeah.
Wars went unscathed.
Yes. So sorry, Anthony. I didn't mean to
Oh,
interrupt, but I
no.
wanted to.
I remember trading an X-Men press kit. Like that had like some sort of fancy like X-Men, original X-Men press kit to the comic book guy. And he's like, and then he like pulls out this VHS from the back room. And I was like, you had it all along,
This is
motherfucker.
like the white nerdy music video where
Yes.
Weird Al goes and buys
It really
a
is. But
brown
that was
baggie that has the holiday special on
he, I
VHS.
remember that. That was
He
such
didn't
a
want cash. He didn't want cash. He wanted that X-Men press kit.
That was such an interesting moment in time too, because I remember like we were just so starved for Star Wars,
Yeah.
but we were all no longer 10. But I remember, yeah, like, you know, they announced they're going to show the trailer in front of Waterboy. And so I drove 50 miles to go see Waterboy where in the trailer, and we watched the trailer, and they're like, if you stay, we'll play it again at the end.
Yeah. Yes, they
Oh.
had to do that because the first time they showed it, like 2/3 of the crowds would leave.
Split. Oh,
Yeah.
wow. Yeah, and
Yeah.
I remember the excitement. I remember, you know, like everyone camping out. And I remember going to the multiplex where my friend was camping out. It looked like the triage scene in or the in Gone with the Wind. It's just like, you know, and you go and
Tent
you
cities
start, I don't know if
everywhere.
you have the same experience, Eric, but I, you know, you
Yeah.
go and you sit down, and the music comes up, and it's holy shit, it's happening. Oh my God, it's happening. And then like the trade viceroy speaks, and you're like, oh no. I just remember audibly loud going, oh no. And my friend just grabs me and goes, oh no. And we're just like, it was from like 2 minutes and 30 seconds in. I'm like, oh, we're screwed. This is not gonna work.
And you know what? It's so fascinating to me. I don't know what it says about me, but the thing that's marking my midlife crisis isn't like, oh, I'm gonna like, oh, I'm getting gray hair, I'm balding or whatever. I'm like, I've lived now long enough to see that generation of Star Wars fans become the mainstream Star Wars fans
Yeah.
that think the prequels are the best, most ideal version of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And you know, it made me kind of zen a bit. It actually helped me make peace a little bit with him because I still don't like those movies, and even Revenge of the Sith, which everybody holds up as the best, has some of my favorite moments in the prequels, but they're I still look at it going, the reason why the prequels kind of for me exist in a world that I can appreciate now has more to do with the Clone Wars and all the filling
Yeah.
in the side stories and actually seeing that relationship between Anakin and Obi-Wan. Because you could just go back and watch the movies, there's no world in which those two are friends. They are constantly shitty to each other. You know,
Yeah.
it's like they're I you don't get any sort of camaraderie with them
Yeah.
at all, but that's all built up in the animated stuff.
Oh, it's very
But
clear when you watch Phantom Menace, you're like, oh, Obi-Wan should have been Qui-Gon, Anakin should have been Obi-Wan. And their falling out should have been a love triangle over Natalie Portman. This should have been the movie. And it was, you know, it's
Lucas.
funny. I never thought, like, if you could go back and tell 10-year-old Joel that there will come a day when Star Wars things will come out that you just don't watch. Like, you just don't care. It's like, I would have slapped you in the face. I've just been flabbergasted by that notion,
But
right? It's just like, no. You know, that just was not possible that, you know, and I can't even name all the things that are on there, but you know, there's a lot of them.
I mean, there's lots of, and with the TV stuff, with the Disney Plus stuff, it's a lot. What I will say is part of that mellowing out on Star Wars, I know this has fuck all to do with Stephen King, but part of the mellowing out on Star Wars has me so because I like Force Awakens, I love The Last Jedi, and The Rise of Skywalker we can just put on in a corner somewhere. But I'm sitting there going, I'm watching all this vitriol online and I'm flashing back. I'm like, am I wise now? Because I remember when I was part of that vitriol machine, because I didn't like Phantom Menace and all that stuff. And all these people that are like, the Disney Star Wars has ruined the legacy. Nobody's ever gonna like it. I'm my dude, you fucking sit there defending how much you love Jar Jar stepping in shit and then zapping his tongue in a fucking laser thing, right? It's like you have no idea. Those kids, I've been to Disneyland and seen fucking 1,000 Rays and Poes and Finns running around.
Oh,
Like
yeah.
that generation is gonna come up for, you know, YouTube hologram tube or whatever the fuck is gonna be the next, you know,
Yeah.
thing. In 15 years you're gonna hear all these people talk about, you know, the classics of the sequel era.
Look, I've got high hopes for what Jon Favreau is going to do with Mandalorian and Grogu. I think he's one of the folks who absolutely gets Star Wars and does it right. And I have very high hopes for what if they ever get to James Mangold's movie. I think Mangold, I'm a huge Mangold fan. You know, it's like, man, you go back to like Ford v Ferrari and A Complete Unknown. It's like he's the only guy doing this movie anymore. Back in the 90s, we got these all the time, these great movies like that. And like Mangold's the only one flying that flag anymore.
And his 310 to Yuma remake, fucking
Oh my God. Yeah.
great.
Mangold's fantastic. But and
Logan.
I think, I think there's some good possibilities of what could happen.
Yeah.
This is
So, I
what happens
mean,
when I talk, and Anthony will tell you this, the conversation just kind of gets squirrely.
oh, well,
Going
you're on the
all
right
over
show for that, Joel. I'll tell you what.
the
So, I think we've kept you long enough. Is there anything that you want to throw out there before we start the wrap up
place.
process? Is there any other thing you want to bring up, or Anthony, is there
No,
anything that you have on your list that I'm now bulldozing through?
I think I said everything I wanted to say about a death.
Okay.
Everything. I
We
was trying
went
to remember
deep.
points or something. Like, don't, but yeah, it's.
Well,
You
Joel,
know, I hope somebody makes a great movie out of it, you know.
where can people watch Rust? Tell us where to find Rust. It's out May 2nd.
Rust, it's in it's a limited theatrical run, so it'll be in like 150 screens, and maybe it will be in a screen in a theater near you. And as with all movies, you should please go to the theater first multiple times instead of only watching anything in your house. Movies are made to be seen on a big screen, but beyond that, same day, you can also watch it on your couch in any way that you favor watching movies, whether it's on Amazon or Apple or Fandango at home, or dial it up through, if you're still rocking cable, God bless you, dial it up through that, you know, through your VOD there and all that, you know.
Yeah, put your
Excellent.
AOL online CD in your CD-ROM and dial it up. Yeah.
And hopefully we'll be out, you know, we'll get a VHS run of it soon, and
VHS.
the old
And then
videos.
you can buy the copy by trading in your X-Men press kit at the local comic
Yeah,
book
always.
shop. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, Joel. I really do
Thank you,
appreciate
Joel.
it. Yeah.
I had a blast, guys. Thanks a lot. Thanks so
Take
much.
care. Be
All
well.
right, take it easy.
Many thanks to Joel Souza for coming on the show. I mean, that was kind of a difficult episode, I gotta say. I have to tell you, I kind of mulled it over for a bit before agreeing to do it. Rust isn't an easy movie to talk about. It's not an easy production, obviously, with the tragedy that happened. And I kind of have to give Souza his due props for being as open and transparent about his personal feelings and why he stuck with the movie after the tragedy and all that stuff. I gotta give it to him. I know I weighed it pretty carefully before agreeing to do the show, but I'm happy that I did. I really enjoyed that conversation. And I think, like I said, I think Souza was very open and transparent and has his heart in the right place on this. And again, it's not an easy conversation to have with two strangers, and he approached it with humility and honesty. So I hope you like it. Now you may have noticed that this episode kind of snuck in our off week. That's good news for you because that means you scored an extra episode of the KingCast this month. Truth be told, we're booked pretty solid, so any exciting guest that pops up between now and say mid-June is either going to have to wait a little or get special treatment like this. So next week we'll be back with the guest that I promised at the end of last week's episode. That's director Julia Max. She made a very cool horror film called The Surrender that Shudder is releasing at the end of May. Her chosen title is Rose Red, which is the fun miniseries from the early aughts with Melanie Lynskey and Julian Sands and Nancy Travis and a bunch of people. It's essentially King's take on Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. So look out for that next week. And in the meantime, make sure to sign up for the show's Patreon over at patreon.com/thekingcast. You get tons of bonus apps, access to the Discord, and all that fun stuff. It's also the best way to directly support the show. So throw us a few bucks and we'll make it worth your while. All right, I think that's about it. So until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.